Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. It is a true privilege to welcome Ava Holler to this episode. Ava's life reads like a living history of the 20th and 21st centuries, one marked by resilience, vision, and an unwavering commitment to justice. Born in Hungary, she survived the Holocaust, endured the siege of Budapest, and came to the United States as a young refugee determined to create a different future. From those beginnings, she has spent her life at the forefront of change, marching with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, traveling with UNICEF to support communities in need, and dedicating decades to mentoring leaders and serving on the boards of nonprofits around the globe. Ava has been recognized with numerous humanitarian awards, but what strikes me most is her lifelong commitment to uplifting others. Through her work, including her inspiring Salon series, which convenes some of the world's most innovative and compassionate thinkers, she reminds us that transformation doesn't happen in isolation, but in community. In this conversation, we'll hear how Ava's extraordinary journey has shaped her into a force for peace and regeneration, and what lessons she has carried from survival to service. Join me as we step into her story, one that shows us how courage, compassion, and using our voices to speak the truth can ripple outward to change the world. Hello, Ava. It's so good to be with you today. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's a lovely day. I'm a little bit hoarse at times, but I'm so excited to be here with you. Having heard some of your podcasts, your brilliance, your warmth is so inviting. So I'm thrilled to be here with you.
Well, thank you so much for saying. And I just want to start out by remarking on how it feels to me like fate has brought us together. I've met you through lovely people in the last number of years, but most recently, I feel that life wanted you and I to meet and to connect through a very special woman who I'm going to name, Yedira, who we both love. So it's through these blessings that we're here today.
It is very true. And we also met through Celeste Bilecci. We were at a dinner event for arts and lectures, and I sat next to you, and I said, "She's gorgeous. Who is she?" And then I lost you for a while, and then Yadi, who is my lifesaver, is a gift from you, and I'm grateful.
Well, that's a beautiful story. I know that we've met at an art gallery. Where we met at Arts and Lectures was Suzanne Simard, Finding the Mother Tree lecture. I mean, that just gives me chills remembering it. And what I've come to learn is how many good, positive, broad-reaching things you have been involved with in your long life. How old are you now?
Well, my long life is very long. I was 95 in May, and I decided that I would like to be 97. The aim is 97. I'm not quite sure why, But it felt like I could sort of ask for 2 more years, but it would be fairly piggish to ask for 5 years. So I am into my 96th year, and I find it quite intriguing to be this old, because when I say it to myself, I feel that I am not talking the truth. I couldn't be this old. Nobody in my family died old. Well, of course, my mother survived 2 world wars. I only survived 1. It is an interesting life looking at it and saying, what have I accomplished, if anything? And what more would I like to accomplish before I go? And when will I be feeling that I'm ready to go? I probably never. You know, there are some of us who at the age of 100 still feel that they are 18. It's a self-delusion that might even have a good purpose.
Right. And could it be that the spirit is immortal? I mean, there's that theory. I don't know how you feel about that, but I know that my father, who just passed at 97 and a half, his spirit was very young. That part didn't change, even though the body has its own time.
It really does. I feel that what do we call religion? What do we call so many different ways of looking at the life we have had and the life we still might have? And I believe deeply that we are spiritual beings and that we are good and that we will hopefully do whatever is the right thing to do whenever the time comes for it. It's a luxury.
Well, so before we go further, because I am 100% sure you and I could drop into a really deep, interesting conversation at any given moment, but what I'd love is for listeners to hear a little bit from you about your unusual history. You mentioned the idea of surviving a war. This war in particular had dire consequences where you grew up. So could you please bring us through a little bit of that early history to give us context?
It is very difficult to do that because the consequences of one act to the next is so hard to understand. You know, I was born in Budapest, Hungary, to a wealthy family. I had 2 brothers, lovely parents. And then the Second World War broke out. And because my father, in 1919, which is way, way back when, I discovered that the anti-Semitism in Budapest was really very cruel. And he decided that we don't need to go through that if we become Christians. Changing religion was a very usual activity amongst people of wealth, because people never thought that if you are a good citizen and if you give contributions to all your synagogues and Catholic Church and all the other, that life will continue. Part of the family realized that there is danger and they left Hungary. The migration, you know, whenever I hear today about who is migrating from where and where does it lead us, most of my family migrated in 1939, which was probably around the last year when people could leave the country. And so my father's brother and sister and their families got visas and left Hungary. My mother felt that we couldn't leave because her parents, my grandparents, were old and they could not have done the trip to get to South America. So we stayed on. So that had its own different consequences.
That's interesting, because really reviewing your life and your voice and what I gather from you, I feel that you must have had a very strong, loving family, like a strong family bond. And what you're describing to me is the value of taking care of one's parents was stronger than possibly escaping. That's a big statement right there. Also, what I'm hearing is possibly a conviction in one's higher power superseded religion. so that it forces one to say, I know who my God is, and I know there's a higher power, and whether I do pink or green religion, it doesn't matter because I'm still connecting with the same higher spiritual being. Is this kind of the idea?
Yes, there is sort of like, I guess, a journey between being an atheist and being a spiritual being. And both of them have interesting opportunities and possibilities. But once you really have to make a decision, if you do, then being an atheist is very tempting, but doesn't feel familiar. It's there in the background, but it is not what I can live by. So I think the most comfortable way for me to see life is to be a spiritual being and be grateful that I can have that road when I need to ride it.
It really comes through when I'm with you. So I just wanted to name that. Well, so you were quite young when the Nazi regime took over where you were living. There's one particular story where you, at the age of 10 or something, resisted a Nazi soldier.
When I look back at that story, I can't imagine that I said what I said. Dear God. And this was the Scottish Institute where Jewish children were hidden by the Scottish mission. And in 1944, it was just too much good luck to not have been taken to Auschwitz and not having been shot to death. So my parents found a way to request the Scottish embassy and the Scottish mission to save the children, and they went into hiding and they left us in a diplomatically safe place. But it wasn't safe, and they came to take us. We were about 40, 50 children there that were left by their parents, hoping that we will survive. And as they lined us up, I looked at that young Nazi soldier and I said, you know, I'm not going with you. And he looked at me because nobody said that. Everybody lined up hoping that if you behave, you know, they are not going to kill you. But I figured, no, I'm not going to go with you. And he sort of looked up, because there were people of all ages who lined up. And I said, you know, I'm much too young and much too beautiful to be killed. And he looked at me, not that he thought I was beautiful, but because I opened my mouth and I contradicted him. And he said, then run! And he had his gun up, but he wasn't going to use it, I hoped. And I ran, and then I realized about 10 steps later that I had an obligation. I was 14, but my mother and this young boy's mother encouraged me to keep him safe. So I ran back. I said, hey, come, let's go. And we ran in the snow. It was December. We didn't know how soon the war would be over in Hungary. We just knew that we had to survive. And so we spent a few hours in the snow trying to find my parents. And we found them, and that made their life very dangerous because they were hiding under fake name and fake everything in the suburbs of the working class. And they lived in two little rooms, a policeman and his wife. And my parents gave them all the money we ever had, whatever they could. And they were hiding my parents. And our showing up, the kid and me, endangered everybody and everything. And I didn't know which of the basement apartments my parents would be. And so luckily, the policeman's wife came out to the courtyard and they grabbed the little boy and me and put us into this little basement apartment. Luckily, the war ended 2 weeks later, maybe 3 weeks later. But we had to spend most of our time in the basement because the air raids. Every evening around 7 o'clock, the Americans were bombing Budapest. And many years later, my beloved husband, number four, he was a bombardier. And many years later, he gave me his diary that he kept as a bombardier. And he said, I bomb Budapest every evening around 7 o'clock. And I said, you know, love, you could have killed me. And he absolutely went either pale or red. Something happened to him that moment when I told him he could have killed me. I said, but don't worry about it. You didn't. I'm here.
Whoa, that is crazy that you came around to meeting someone who was bombing the city you were in. That's wild. Okay, so you were then living out the ending of the war in the basement with your family. I know that there was an arrangement that sent you to Ecuador at some point. Was it immediately thereafter, or did it take a while?
No. At the time we were liberated, we thought that the Americans are coming to occupy Hungary. Well, no, the Soviets came. And they managed to rape every woman, every girl, everything, to rob us from anything we had. It was a very cruel liberation, quote-unquote. They continued to occupy. And then during that time, we tried to get back to what used to be our home, which now was occupied in each room another family. It was a difficult period to feel safe from the Soviets and yet feel that the Germans and the Hungarian Nazis were killing. The Soviets stole anything they found because they've been in the war years already. Their shoes, the bottom of their shoes had holes in them. January in Budapest was a very cold weather. And so their occupying Budapest meant that whatever clothing, whatever they could take, steal money, jewelry, and whatever. But mainly their interest was to have a pair of boots. You know, in some ways it was hard to hate them because they really had a terribly difficult life in the Soviet army for years. So they stole all the food. They were hungry for sex, for food, for life. They were young guys, a number of millions who were killed in that war. They were fairly wild.
I mean, they themselves were young and traumatized by the ravages of a terrible war. Well, what strikes me is your ability to see their humanity and not just blatantly hate another group.
I don't like hate. It takes up too much energy. I didn't learn to like them, but I could understand the years they spent in the cold, in the hunger. And now they want something. They want a country, and they were going to get whatever they get out of it and use their frustration.
So you lived through that period as a young girl still, in your teenage years.
I left Hungary in December of 1948. I was 18 years old, and my aunt and uncle, whom my parents funded to get out of Hungary and ended up in Ecuador. No other country was willing to take in Jews by then. They figured they already got enough Jews. And they would say, well, what is a Jew? Well, those are people that probably have horns, and we don't want that kind of people in our country. Some of the boats that were filled with kids and were sent on to Israel were sent right back by the Brits. So it was very difficult to feel part of humanity because humanity was lacking. But that is a story that is later and different.
So here you are, a young woman sent far away to another continent. Were you alone?
Yes. And you know, because of the wars and because of our hiding and because of all those things that happened, I was very uncivilized. You know, I have never traveled outside of my country. I didn't know if I will get to a place where I will be admitted. I arrived to Paris. Now I turn it around. I'm 18. And when I was in Budapest in my education and whatever, I loved all the stories that had as a background the Café de la Paix in Paris. That was my dream, that one day I will be at Café de la Paix having a cup of coffee and a croissant. But I really didn't have the kind of money that would allow me. But just to sit down there at that park, at the Paris Opera, and you know, it was interesting that with all the living underground, not having good clothes, shoes, or anything for so many years. And then my uncle in Ecuador sent a visa to Paris for me that they will await me when the ship lands in Guayaquil. And they now will have a new home for me. Meanwhile, we found out that my brother was killed. He was a partisan with Tito. Lots of things happened between 1945, when we were liberated, and 1948, when my mother said, "You cannot stay here. You cannot live here. I need to send you away." And I said, "Mother, all I have is you and my father, who had coronary thrombosis at that point." And mother said, "You know, there is no hope for you here. There's nothing for you. Go and we'll figure it out later. But go to your uncle." And so I went. And I was 18 and I traveled on a cargo ship. And that took quite a few weeks from south of Italy, where I got on the ship, to Guayaquil.
First of all, the pressures of the war and the dangers even post-war and the Soviet occupation, that all is like intense pressure and danger. And then here you are, a young woman in Paris, having her cup of coffee. And what I hear is that you had an education that taught you about places outside your own experience. And I hear a really vibrant sense of imagination and possibility. That's what I hear in you from a young age.
I think I would consider it my survival muscle, because there I was 10 days in Paris, and I met a young man on the train, and we decided by the time we hit Paris, all those hours on the train, that we might want to spend time together. He was going to Australia to relatives who got there before the war, and I was going to Ecuador. So we knew we are not going to have a love affair, but it was so nice to have somebody. I could talk Hungarian, and we made a date to go to the Louvre, and we spent 10 days together museuming, and it was such magic, because he was much better off than I. He had diamonds in cigarettes, in the kind of cigarettes that you remove the tobacco, put in the diamonds, put back the tobacco. And how would anybody know that diamonds are the girl's best friend? He was a lovely young man, and we had a lovely time together. And because he had money, he has diamonds, I had a $20 bill hidden in my luggage.
And you had a great spirit. That's what you brought with you as well. So these 10 days, what I hear is one who is able to take an opportunity and live it right now, right here, right now. Like, you have this opportunity. I'm in Paris and I'm going to live it to the fullest. In the middle of bad fortune, you might say, there is always some good fortune. And it sounds like you were able to grasp that.
It was so delicious. It was Paris. I mean, imagine 18 in Paris with a lovely young man. Now, the fact is that I used up my $20 by buying baguettes, and he had much more than I had. So I brought the bread and he brought the whatever to put in the bread. Yeah, it was lovely. And then he went off to Australia. I arrived to Ecuador, and it was a small village where my aunt and uncle settled. They never really learned Spanish. They lived in pretty bad poverty. And they were old, very old, and not well. So it was a difficult time to manage. What can I do and not to be a burden? It was clear that I was a burden. They couldn't afford to have one more mouth to feed. So that was a very painful and difficult period.
And you didn't speak the language either.
Not a word. But the young man in that village kept coming to look me over because it was a small village and I was that gringa. And one of them kept on coming back, and he was a lieutenant in the Air Force, coming from a very high-class family of the Gallo Plaza Lasso of the Ecuadorian president. And he kept on coming, and he was very handsome and very pleasant, and he was teaching me Spanish. And 6 months later, he married me.
Did you have a choice in that one, or was it sort of arranged, or how was it in those days? I mean, in those circumstances as well.
Well, there was nobody to arrange it. My old aunt and uncle were having their own problems because their daughter married a native guy who was difficult.
So it was your decision. You had your own agency in making that choice.
Yes. Well, there was nobody else who could advise me what to do. And in 6 months, I did learn enough Spanish that I could say yes when the priest asked the question. It was okay for maybe 3 months, 4 months. And I was pregnant with my son. And he was born in 1950.
So you're 20 now.
I'm 19 when I married. I was 20. My son was born in October of 1950, and he was a big, fat, healthy, happy boy. And that was my decision time. I never told this story. Actually, most of the things you and I talk about, I never talked before. I need to figure out what is it in you that bring out stories I have not thought about or I never wanted to think about or wanting and needing to share it. I'll have to think about that.
I feel your soul and your spirit. I can feel it. And I feel a draw for you to share. How is this? What was this experience like for you? That's what I'm really interested in, because how you manifest and shape and form that soul and spirit throughout a lifetime, we can see some aspects. And I'm just so curious about the inner experience.
But the inner experience was, I was scared. I think I was scared much of my life. And therefore, I recall that most of the time I was trying to figure out, is there another way? Is there a way out? But what can I do? And here I have this beautiful 10-pound boy.
And you're not a big woman.
No, that cesarean was quite interesting because since my husband was in the army, it was a military hospital where I was taken to give birth. And they didn't have an OBGYN in the military hospital. So the surgeon decided after a while that we have to have a cesarean. And his appreciation of the size of the cut and what to bring out called the child, his experience was not overwhelming. So I got a cut in the shape of an L. I guess he needed to cut a little bit more because the kid was so big. So that was an interesting experience. And I figured, okay, now I am damaged goods. I have to figure it out.
That's how it felt in a way. Yes. So at some point, here you are in a foreign country with a child, still a very young person. This guy must not have been the best guy on earth because you decided to leave and somehow you obtained a divorce at that time. Is that unusual?
Very. Also because he came from a very fancy family. It wasn't really done. But I think that he wanted the divorce as much as I did. He was on the base. He was back home. He was drunk most of the time. He beat me up every time he came home late at night. So I was afraid physically of what's going to happen. And I grabbed my kid and I took him to my aunt and uncle, who really didn't have very much. But I figured it out that I can get a job. And I did. I became secretary to the president of the bank. The reason I got that fancy job is because Ecuador was being discovered for all kinds of minerals and whatever. And foreign business people started coming to figure out how they invest into what. And so luckily, as a child, I first had a German nanny. And then I was 10 or 11, I started learning English. Language became very important in my family because we all felt that if we need to escape from Hungary, nobody speaks Hungarian and nobody wants to speak Hungarian. You know, it sounds like dog barking if you listen to Hungarian. So I figured that's not what I want for my kid. But with the Spanish that I learned and the English that I knew from before as a kid, I was a commodity. That's why I was able to get the job at the bank. But it was not a good thing for the kid, for my child, because his father didn't really want to have children. And he was a free guy who was having some affairs that really made it very hard to be married. And since beating me was really very unpleasant, I took my baby and moved in with my aunt and uncle who had even less than before, but I could sort of help to support them with my job. And then my cousin, whose family left in 1938-39, came to Ecuador, everybody, but they were luckier because they were much better educated. And they got visas and came to New York. And I realized at the time when I was being beaten and I had a two-year-old kid and no future, that I have to get out. And I suggested to my husband, how about if we get a divorce? Would you mind? And he said, it's okay. I don't really like being married. So we got a divorce and I left my two-year-old child with my aunt and my uncle. And I arrived to New York. I had a 6 weeks visitor's visa. I was so lucky that I spoke English. So I had started cleaning houses, apartments, and I figured I will find a way to save up enough money to bring out my kid. And that took 6 years.
Oh, what a big sacrifice.
My son comes here to see me every couple of months. My 10-pound boy is now 75 years old.
Wow. Well done. I mean, the little I know of him, it sounds like you two have a beautiful relationship. And the strength of, again, that spirit and that family connection feels like it carried despite the hardship and the separation.
My son is married to a Superior Court justice, and they have a very beautiful, very luxurious life at home in the Long Island Sound.
So you're very much in each other's lives. You're very connected, yes.
Oh, yeah. And next week I'll be seeing my granddaughter's new home on Long Island Sound also. Everybody lives in a very small circle. My son and his wife, my grandson and granddaughter and their kids and whatever. And I have my home in Manhattan. And it's amazing to feel that we created a family, and a fairly sizable family, because my grandson married a very large family, and my granddaughter too also. So I am grandma. And then my son's boys call me great-grandma.
That's fantastic. That has to be so satisfying to feel that generational strength and beauty. And the fact that this family, which sounds like it started out strong, survived. I mean, it's a story of survival and resilience and sustainability. And I would say, you know, the theme of this podcast is regenerative mindset. And I feel that throughout the stories you've shared so far is a regenerative mindset. How do we create more positive life, whatever it is we're being given? And there are some very difficult circumstances that you were faced with. And out of each one, you sowed seeds of positive possibility. That's what I'm hearing. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that if you feel like sharing about what that resilience and regenerative spirit that you seem to have.
I consider it my survival muscle when I'm suddenly faced with something that I don't really want to face. What my survival muscle will tell me. Where do I turn? And I think that I found my way in philanthropy. And I never thought about it because I was given. I never gave. I was given this generosity. I was given not necessarily money, though sometimes money, but given advice, given shelter, given the United States. When I left Hungary, they stamped my passport and the stamp said, stateless. Once you leave Hungary, you are no longer a citizen. And I still have that passport from when I was 18. It says stateless.
So you lost your country of origin when you fled to safety so that you might survive to see another day.
That's right. So I was stateless.
And then you married. Did you become Ecuadorian? And then when did you become American?
I went to school at night in New York to the U School for Social Research. And I hoped to get a degree or two while I'm there at night. And the dean of students, Clara Meyer, she became so kind. She asked me into her office. And I either worked at night and went to school during the day or vice versa, depending on what I could, how to manage my life. And she would give me some of her clothes. And the Meyer family, who was the founders of the new school and was wealthy, I owned the most exquisite clothing.
Cleaning homes in your Saks Fifth Avenue best. What a brilliant juxtaposition. And what you're speaking to is you were given opportunities and gifts. And I also hear there were nonprofits and philanthropies that were instrumental even early on. And so that was a thread I was kind of pulling. It's through these programs, through these family nonprofits or whatnot, people that actually knew to set up funding and opportunity for people in need. That feels to me like it may have carried through and become so important for you at some point.
Oh, totally. I mean, I didn't become a philanthropist just to become one. I didn't even know the term. What happened was that I was given. Clara Meyer invited me to dinner at her incredible brownstone on 72nd Street. And there were 6-7 people around the table. And it was Bill Styron, the author. It was everybody. I mean, luckily, I read some of the authors. But in the meanwhile, I was a student there. And I was the only student. But I was invited several times. And she got a kick out of watching me in her outfits and in my new persona. I think she got a kick out of it. I was bewildered. I didn't understand my luck and where will it take me. And Clara Meyer took me and I went and got my master's. And it was an amazing experience to suddenly turn around and that lovely author, friend of Bill Styron's, John Maloney, I was in a bit of a problem because I had a student visa and it was a 6 weeks visa and then a student visa. And you know, how much longer can I carry it? And I still couldn't bring my kid. I needed the citizenship so I could bring him. So John Maloney, who sat next to me at one of the Clara Meyer dinners, was intrigued by me. And by then, I must have been like 24 years old, 25 years old. And he married me. And Bill Styron and Rose, his wife, invited us to have our honeymoon in their lovely home in Connecticut. And so it looked like life was going to be good, but it really wasn't. And John couldn't handle the marriage and his generosity to marry me so that I can get the citizenship or the green card and whatever going. And he sort of said, no, I really can't do this. And I was called into Internal Revenue. I was called into Immigration and to deport me because I faked a marriage. I didn't fake it. He just couldn't handle the responsibility that he undertook. And I said to him, you know, don't worry about it. I'll find a way out.
It was a short marriage, it sounds like.
It was 10 days.
That's very short. Is that not enough for you to secure citizenship?
No, it wasn't enough, but mainly the problem was that he just came out a month before from the veterans hospital because he had a nervous breakdown. And I called on the 10th day when he became dangerous to me. I went up to Westchester to the VA. I said, please tell me what's wrong and what can I do? And the doctor said, you know, he had no right to get married. He's so frail. You know, we just let him loose. We let him out. He cannot handle any responsibility, including his own. So that marriage cannot be. So I came back and we met up at the immigration office because they called me in and called him in because it all looked so wrong, so fake.
Artificial, maybe.
Artificial. I found him sitting on a bench at immigration and I said, what are you doing here? He said, I want to talk to them. And so they called us both in. And I said, John, don't ruin my life. And he said, I'm not planning to. So we went in and the immigration officer said, please tell me, what is your story? Who are you guys? And John said, well, we had a fight and I got angry. But I love her and she's my wife and I won't do this again. I was flabbergasted. He was so kind. And they let us go, and they stamped my green card. And outside in the office, I hugged him. I said, you are such a good man. I thank you. I never saw him again.
Wow. These opportunities and angels that showed up.
And so often.
Yes. Although what I'm hearing throughout is that something you said earlier, that in danger, there were people who thought staying silent and just going along, stay quiet, and one will become safe. And what I feel that I'm hearing is that you did not stay quiet. You spoke up and you spoke up and you spoke up and said, what about this? You know, starting with the Nazi soldier, going towards this husband in Ecuador, what if we get a divorce? How about it? That's the impossible at that time, and you said it. And then many circumstances I'm hearing, you using your voice has been key to your survival and thriving in evolution in your life. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. You put it beautifully. Really. And not only you put it beautifully, but you gave it back to me beautifully. And as you were talking, I was absorbing what you are seeing into who I am. And I didn't know these things. I didn't know any of these things about me that you found. This is a beautiful gift you are giving me.
And I love how here we are again, what you're giving me. I have Technicolor imagery and experience that you're sharing now that I haven't lived, but through your storytelling, you're absolutely sharing with me something I haven't lived, but you're gifting me. So this is what's beautiful about a conversation. What's sitting right in front of me is the moment we're living through right now. There's so much more that we can talk about, but the moment we're living in right now has markers of fascism, of political extremism. There is racial discrimination that's on the rise and difficult things happening with immigrants and people who may or may not be immigrants. So I wonder, someone who has lived this many decades and lived through these eras, how do you view the moment right now? What is your view? I mean, how do you see it as similar and how is it different? What would you say about what you're experiencing.
I'm scared. I'm uncomfortable. I feel like imprisoned in so many ways when I listen. I was listening this morning to Robert Kennedy Jr. I couldn't stop myself. I just had to listen to the danger, to the millions of children will die because they're not going to be vaccinated. How we are creating a whole different kind of a health system, and that this guy is getting away with it. So that's pretty scary. My friends went to Uruguay for a visit, and they found that little country to have more democracy than they ever seen here. And so my family, my adopted family, are all buying land and building homes in Uruguay. Does this sound like when my aunt and uncle left Hungary for Ecuador? Is it now my adopted family going to Uruguay, and they've been there now 3 years, and the rest of the family is going next month to finish building their homes there, and they are enjoying it, and they find the democracy there so special. And I said, I would love to go with you. It's a 19 hours flight, and I don't think I could handle the experience of 19-hour flight to Uruguay. And I would love to be there. I love the idea of finding another paradise, like when we found America.
Well, so sometimes the only option available is to leave an oppressed environment. If you have the opportunity, leaving is one of your choices, is one of our choices. I know a number of people that are becoming expatriates. And I think we share some friends that bought property in Uruguay, and I've heard very good things. But many of us are thinking, is this something we need to do? This is unthinkable because we imagined that what happened with World War II couldn't happen again. There's some belief that we've learned our lesson, but that doesn't seem to be so. And what I just want to point to is of all of the philanthropy, I mean, you're saying you never set out to be a philanthropist, but you have helped to create, served on boards of so many programs. I mean, it's just too large to mention, that have assisted others in one way or another, whether it's in circumstances or in spirit or in opportunity. It is profound how much you have done. And I'm wondering, does it feel that is still somewhere that we should and could and might put our efforts? Like, what do you see as our avenues right now? Oh, wise one.
It is so easy when you see the end. You know, I'm 95 and I have more money now than I ever had before. It sort of feels like every time I give it away, some new money comes in from somewhere or something. So I can't seem to have given it all away, which is what I would like to do. Some of the organizations are 25 years old this year, and it feels so right. Sing for Hope is such a beautiful organization.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's what was on my mind, is that's preposterously fabulous.
Monica Yunus, who is Dr. Mohamed Yunus's daughter, the Nobel laureate. I was at an event with Steve Hilton, and I saw Monica Yunus there, and I just saw her on television that her father got the Nobel Peace Prize. And so I went over to her and I congratulated her. I said, this is terrific. She said, well, I'm leaving tomorrow for the celebration of the Nobel. We talked for a few minutes about how to use such fame for good causes. And that was that. And she went off to Sweden. And she came back, and she and her friend Camille, two opera singers, they already had their masters from Juilliard, and they all had their opera roles already. And they said they want to invite me for lunch. They want to ask some question. And I said, you know what? I don't go out for lunch. But if you come into my home for lunch, I would love that. That dining room table of mine was started that day, Sing for Hope. And for 25 years, we've been together and served thousands of young people who went through Juilliard or whatever they went through, and they have no jobs. And music was so taken away from so many schools, the music programs.
This program has these pianos that you literally have brought to Central Park. Is this some of it? Can you explain?
When we realized that there are no music classes in our schools, we decided to give the schools pianos. And since we had 1,500 musicians who didn't have jobs, we give a piano and we also give the teacher. And the kids got music back in their lives. And then we got a number of enormously wealthy people who loved the idea. I have probably about 10 billionaires who give us a lot of money. It's really wonderful because we were able to then ship to refugee camps in Europe. We have shipped pianos. And Joyce Di Donato, my beloved Joyce, goes every year and does piano lessons and singing with the kids in refugee camps. We've been doing that for over 10 years. And my beloved Joyce comes back again and again. She's coming to Santa Barbara. She's going to be singing in Santa Barbara in February.
So Santa Barbara, I want to segue to how did you end up in Santa Barbara? Because I hear how important New York has been, and you consider it your home, which I didn't know because I've only known you here. But how did Santa Barbara become one of the places that you really spend time and have a lot of friends?
My late husband, number four, the love of my life. We were asked to come to the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions that was headed by Dr. Hutchins from Chicago. And the center was a remarkable place. From Aldous Huxley to Thomas Mann, there was nobody who wasn't there. The institution of Center for the Study was extraordinary. And my husband was invited to come. And one of the things they did, I knew about them while I was house cleaning 10 years prior, that I would turn on the radio and I would hear lectures from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And while I was vacuuming the floor, I always turned off the vacuum cleaner because I needed to hear who is there. So when Mary was invited to come to the center and help them to set up a couple of programs, I couldn't believe it that he and I ended up on Alston. It looked like a Grecian temple with ornaments beyond. I just cried, you know, and I looked out from the terrace and I saw the ocean. So that was really the beginning of so much. Anyhow, we then gave pianos to everybody under the sun in prisons, but of course the refugee camps. And it takes, I think there are 83 or 86 keys on a piano. So whatever that number was, the number we wanted to give away every year to schools and to prisons and to hospitals and all of that. That was really the beginning, and it continues.
Right. 25 years of Sing for Hope. That's beautiful. It's interesting that music maybe cuts through to the human spirit again, is what it feels to me like. It goes direct, perhaps, and offers hope.
Yeah, we sing for hope, and the fact that 25 years later we are still together is pretty good. But nowadays, nobody gives us $50,000, which, you know, when I gave my first 50, that was huge because I didn't have it until then. But nowadays we have incredibly dedicated people who tell us that this 5 million is for 5 years. And really, it's been amazing because with COVID, we gave up the office. And now we are working without physical office because we really don't need it that much.
Things have changed, have gotten more remote.
And it works. Whenever we want to have a staff meeting, kind of a meeting for up to maybe 15 people, but you can do it at my home in New York. You know, for that, you don't have to have space. That's a good enough space.
The pandemic changed many things, I will say, and some for the better. You know, this reminds me that during the pandemic, you started Ava Haller's Salon Series. And it just seems that you brought brilliant people to our homes for years. And that felt like an act of service as well.
That was a surprise. Nobody expected it to be. In 2020 afternoon, we got together on Zoom. I was in Santa Barbara and most of our friends were East Coast. And the question really was, are we going to have a lockdown? If there is going to be a lockdown, how is it going to affect our work, our philanthropy? How will it affect us with each other in terms of our planning together and doing together and whatever? We were eight of us. And I always call on Jerry White when I want heavyweight because he's a Nobel laureate. And then I can call on Dr. Yunus, no Lober. Hey guys, we are going to have a meeting next week, a virtual dinner. And the following week, everybody showed up and they brought along a few other celebrities. And ever since then, every Saturday, I have the speaker for 35 minutes and then Q&A. And then in an hour, we all go and do our thing. And so far, we have had a lot of speakers, a couple of hundred.
I've gotten to listen to some of them, and it's just such a brilliant group, first of all. And getting to have that peek into, like having access to learning from these brilliant people is a gift, and it's so neat. And for anybody who wants to go look up this library, really. So it just feels like something circumstantial that just showed up, and there you are being Ava. Creating more out of less. I mean, literally.
Well, this Saturday, we are going to have Jerry White, who has been the one who opens every year. This is our sixth season. So this is Jerry's sixth performance. Hey, Jerry, could you open the next year's session? And I then looked at Peter Sagal, a number of guys, many women. And we get a kick out of getting together when the session is over, because we can see everybody's face if they want us to. And it's a family. It's good. It works. And every year I think, okay, that's going to be the end. And then towards the end, two or three, somebody shows up from a foreign country or from wherever they come from and say, hey, could we be speakers for your next season? And I wasn't planning it. How many seasons can you have?
I like that. How many seasons can you have? And I feel that you are the goddess of fresh starts. Like you manifest fresh starts and you're always open and willing. And that is, to me, the epitome of regenerative, what longevity in youth, eternal, actually.
But that is your podcast. That's exactly your podcast. And you are not saying I will have an end or this will be an end or I've got to change this. You just bring people back in. They want to have more.
So there's a sense about you that does two things in my estimation. One, you experience an opportunity and you have the courage to speak into an opportunity and not go, oh, well, I'll just stay quiet. But I also see you following. There's a following energy about you that I'm here and what life presents, I'm going to work with that and see what sparks. And you've worked with others always. I hear interaction with others throughout your stories. And the way you weave that is brilliant.
I just am very lucky, incredibly fortunate, because first of all, nobody in my family had a very long life. Both sides of the family, the longest life was 72 years. And in a way, I get a kick out of it. You know, it's sort of a, hey, look, I'm still here.
I just am loving this and would love to do another. But before we go, can you just share the moment what you see as your current inspiration right now?
The blue sky, the fact that I am here with you, that's very important. To meet new friends, to make friends, is an amazing challenge and enormous need. And as long as I can enjoy and have new friends. Well, the old friends, that is for granted, of course, because after all, I have several emails here telling me who is going to be at my welcome home party next Tuesday in New York, and a few others who are going to be doing it a few days after. I am so privileged. There is nothing greater joy in life than loving humans and being loved back. The challenge of opening the door so that the love can come in is probably a hard job, but I love doing it.
Well, that is brilliant. I love that. And I think you are absolutely right. The challenge of opening the doors, continuing to open doors year after year, day after day. And that is a brilliant way to live. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.